It's Laura Taylor on Weekend Journal on US 99.5. This is going to be a fun interview. We're joined by author Mary Jo Sontag. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you very much.
So you have a book out that you wrote with Mary Kay Sontag. Now, is she your sister? Am I getting that
no,
right?
No, she's my mother.
She's your mother. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes.
It's Write If You Live to Get There. Write as
That's
in
right.
Write a letter. W-R-I-T-E. And this is a fascinating book because it tells the story of America expanding westward, but you're telling that through family letters, your own personal family letters that go back 120 years. This is not your average history book. This is pretty cool stuff, I have to say.
Yes, thank you. The letters range from 1842 to 1962.
Yeah, so now what made you decide to write this book? Because that's quite an undertaking to go back that far. 1842, I mean, that's not easy to find information from back then. So what was it about the Phillips family, that's your ancestral family from Vermont, that made you want to write this book?
When her mother died in 1962, my mother inherited a white wooden chest that was filled with letters, photographs, and memorabilia dating back to 1842. And she put those letters on a shelf in the bedroom closet while she raised her family. But then in 1992, I went on a business trip to Sacramento, California, and took a side trip to Placerville, where I found the family tombstones in the Union Cemetery. And so when I came back home, I told Mom if she would get the letters out of the closet, that I would take her to California. And so we spent the next year organizing those letters, and in May of 1993, we took our first trip to California following the path that our ancestors had taken and decided that we would write the book. And that writing the book was a 14-year labor of love.
Oh, my gosh.
The letters, you can imagine some of the condition of them was really not very good. And so my mother sat with her magnifying glass reading them and wrote them out by hand on legal pad, gave them to me, and then I had them typed. And there are over 200 letters.
That's not easy. Wow, that is quite an undertaking. Props to you guys, because I can imagine a lot of people who want to know about their ancestors, they might think, oh, that's too much work. You know, they probably would just give up before they even begin. So the fact that it took you 14 years and you stuck with it and you have this amazing book, which, by the way, includes actual photographs and the actual image of the letters so you can see the handwriting. It's so cool. I mean, good for you guys. That's amazing.
Thank you. We're really quite proud of it.
You should be. And so I haven't read the whole book yet, but I did notice that up on Amazon, they have a preview. So I've been kind of reading the beginning of the book, and there's this one part where it says that when you're visiting the cemetery out in California in the early 90s, you find your great uncle Dan's grave and you notice fresh flowers. And you
yes.
think, well, there's got to be family nearby. What was the feeling like when you saw those flowers? Because that must indicate right there, oh, this is on, because we can actually find somebody to talk to.
Well, it was the beginning of the adventure, right?
Yeah.
So we were so excited to find those because my mother thought that everyone was dead. And so that meant that someone was still there. And we tried to call the owner of the cemetery, but it was Memorial Day weekend, and he told us to come back. So we began our own adventure then and went on to Lake Tahoe, and at the inn at Meeks Bay, there was a young girl working at the front desk, and I said to her, I told her who I was and where I was from and what I was doing, that we were researching the Phillips family. And she said, oh, I know all about your ancestors. I studied them in my Women of the West class at the University of Nevada. And so she said the owner of the inn will just be thrilled to know that you're here. And so he called all the other people from the different historical societies around Lake Tahoe, because my mother had in her folder pictures, and she had a map of the railroad that went through Lake Tahoe, all kinds of documents that had been burned and they had never seen before. And so while she was talking with them, I called the Historical Society in El Dorado County, and the director there told me, he said, your family was very important to the settlement of Northern California, especially El Dorado County. I'm like, I'm beginning to get that idea. And so he told us to come to the museum and that Sally must be thrilled that we were in California. But we didn't know who Sally was. And so here, when we got there, it turned out that Sally and my mother, when they had been children, had exchanged letters and gifts of dried fruit at Christmas for years, but then they had gone separate ways, and they didn't know that each other were alive. So my mother called her and said, you know, do you remember how we used to exchange gifts when we were children? And Sally said, yes, I do. I'll be right there in 15 minutes. So that was just a rekindling of a relationship.
Oh, that's so
cool. It was very
exciting. Yeah, that's very exciting. So the book is kind of twofold, because we learn a lot about the Phillips family, your ancestors, but we also kind of get a picture for America back in the 1800s, the 1900s. So what are some of the issues that people are facing when they're traveling west back in the 1800s? It's not like you can pull out your cell phone and look up the traffic, or if you're sick, you can't go to the Walgreens. You know, it's a lot different. So what are some things that people faced when they traveled west?
Well, one thing that they faced as they came across Illinois were tornadoes. And there's a letter that says, one day a tornado came by and struck the general store where JWD was working. He and his cousin jumped under the counter for protection. The whole building went sailing off, leaving the foundation in place and the two men safely under the counter. And that was the event that encouraged JWD to leave Illinois and go to California.
Yeah, tornadoes freak me out. They can do some serious damage. I can imagine that back then, too. That would just be really scary.
Another problem would be the rains. You know, they would be so heavy that they would wash out the roads and the creeks and the rivers would flood. And so it made it really difficult to go anywhere. For example, there were two sisters that lived very close to each other, but because of the poor conditions of the road, they could only correspond by mail. They couldn't see each other for months at a time.
Oh, wow. They can't just send a text.
No text. And then there was the snow in the Sierras. You know, there's one letter that talks about Alden, a hired man, and the Chinese cook who spent the winter up at Phillips Station, their resort. And they were really snowed in. The only entertainment they had was the Chinaman and his fiddle. And they couldn't wait for spring to come. So other problems that they faced were disease. There was the ague fever. There was quinsy, which was a bacterial infection in the throat. Typhoid, diphtheria, tuberculosis, those were all really very common. And as they came across, other struggles that they had would be to find work.
I didn't think about that part of it.
Sometimes because of the insect plagues, like in Kansas and Illinois, the insects, the grasshoppers, the potato worms, and other insects would just ravage all their crops, and so they'd have nothing to sell and not much to eat. So they had a lot of things they had to contend with.
Yeah, it's a fascinating look back at that time. I think we forget about how it was back then, but it's also fascinating to learn about the family, too. And throughout the book, there are females in the Phillips family that keep coming up that seem to be an inspiration to you. Tell us about some of the women in the family that really inspired you and why they inspired you.
Well, the matriarch was Mehitable Jane, and she divorced her first husband because he was a sympathizer in the Civil War, and she said she was a Yankee and she would have none of that. So she divorced him at a time when that was really unheard of.
Yeah, no, that is unprecedented for that time.
And then I think the woman that inspires me the most is Sierra Nevada Phillips. She was named for the mountains, and they called her Vade. She was a 5'2" bundle of energy. It said that she greeted everyone with a joke and sent them away with a smile. They said that her only fault was her overgenerous heart, and she was known as being the best cook in the Sierras. So she actually ran three resorts at Lake Tahoe. One was at Meeks Bay, one was at Rubicon Springs, and the other was at Phillips Station. And she was very enterprising. The resort at Rubicon Springs was known for its hot mineral springs, and she bottled that water and marketed it with a slogan saying that it tastes better than whiskey.
She was ahead of her time.
She was.
Wow.
Very much ahead of her time. And I really admire her because she had a lot of spunk. she was independent, and she had a real entrepreneurial spirit. And she was known everywhere for her hospitality, her cooking, and her business skills.
Well, I think I could learn a lot from her. She sounds like she was ahead of her time, and like a lot of people really liked her. And there were a lot of letters in the book, too. As I mentioned, you can actually see the letter and see the handwriting. Were there certain letters that you found that really stood out that you can't get out of your head? Do you have a favorite letter?
Yes, I do. This letter was written by my great-grandmother, Mary Phillips, in 1907. She was in California writing to her children. And the letter begins, "We left this land of sleet and snow Friday, the 25th of October, and arrived at the land of sunshine and flowers on Tuesday, the 29th. We started in such a hurry we forgot our candles and provisions, except for a few baked beans and some fried bear meat. In a strange place, in the dark, and trying to get something to eat, you can imagine how we looked. Vade would light a stick from the fire outside. By the time she got in, it would be out. I stumbled on a can of lard and told Vade we'd have light. I took a piece of cloth off an old apron I had on and tied a stone in and put it in a pan of lard and set fire to it. Vade said the light of it would make an electric light ashamed of itself." Later on, she writes, "Jim was driving a spring wagon with a box hitched on behind with a black pig in it weighing 150 pounds. Above that was a coop of chickens. On top of that was our can of lard, packed meats, carpets, rugs, and a little of everything. They put the calf in with the pig. We watched the calf and the pig. Sometimes the calf would be under the pig, then we'd call Jim, and he'd get out and fix them up." And the reason I really like this letter is that it was pouring rain this whole time. It took them 4 days to go a distance of 60 miles.
Oh, my gosh.
It would take us an hour today. And she is writing in the letter that they laughed so hard that their sides ached and that this is one of the best times she ever had and how much she liked it out there. So to me, it's a real story of family and connection.
Yeah, the storytelling in here is remarkable. If you're just joining us, we're talking with author Mary Jo Sontag, Write If You Live to Get There, W-R-I-T-E. We're writing letters. And to read these letters now in a day where we're sending emails and we're sending text messages and going on social media, it's such a nice contrast. Such a nice reminder to be reminded about how it was back in the 18 and 1900s. Such a different world now. And when you were reading some of these letters, did you kind of start to see some of your ancestors in yourself a little bit? Did you see any connection there at all?
When I looked at the women in this family, I thought that I had inherited their independent spirit and definitely their sense of adventure. Also, their spunk, and I love to cook and entertain as well. So it was fun to see those comparisons.
You've traveled the world yourself, too, haven't you?
I started traveling when I was 16, so just about the age that some of them were when they left Pennsylvania for California.
There's also a ton of photographs in the book, and I feel like they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. I don't think it does it justice. I think a picture is worth countless words. I love photos, and I love looking through old photos from my family, too. I'm sure that there were some that you found that you just thought, oh my gosh, you know, who is that? Or, oh, I see, you know, my mother's eyes in this person. Tell us about some of the photos that you found.
Well, there are two that really stand out in terms of pictures of family members. And one is a picture of all of the Phillips women sitting on the front porch. And they just look so strong and determined that it's a picture that I really like to see. And it has significance because when my mother and I were on our adventure, we went to Calaveras State Park. And because it was pouring raining, we went into the visitor center. And there I picked up a book called Women of the Sierra, and I flipped open to this very picture. That was another clue that people were alive and someone had donated that book. So I like that picture very much. And then there's another picture of Great Uncle Dan, and he was a true pioneer. He was a miner, a rancher, a stagecoach driver, and a forest ranger. And although he said, "I ain't much of a writer," he's the bedrock of the family and the person that connected the family through letters. He wrote to everyone.
I just love the fact that there are these letters. You know, the communication, it seems like it was better back then when it was harder to reach somebody than sometimes it is now. I love that. I just love knowing that the family stayed so close together through letters. It takes so much time to get to the person you're writing to, and then you have to wait for the response. That's just remarkable.
Well, sometimes it would take over a year for the letters to arrive. So it was a challenge for the letters to get from the States to the frontier, and then once they got out there, to get through the Sierras, especially in the wintertime. So it was very challenging, and they never knew really if the letters were getting through or not.
Blind faith, I guess, is kind of getting you through it. Is there anything?
There is another picture of the resort at Phyllis Station that I like very much. When you think about a resort, you know, you're thinking about swimming pools and spas. But back then, a resort meant that it was tent camping, and people would come from Sacramento and San Francisco to spend the summer there. And while there were some permanent buildings like the dining hall and another building where the men played cards and drank whiskey, most of the activities were all carried on outside. So it's a very different kind of resort experience.
Yeah, but you get some fresh air and some fun adventure, I would imagine, right?
Yes, yes. I wanted to tell you about something else about Uncle Dan, and that was he and my great-grandmother were closest in terms of ages, and they spent the whole book really talking about getting together. She was back here in western Pennsylvania, and he was in California. And he would say to her, "If luck comes my way, I will come and see you. If not, I will keep on digging and live in hope."
Oh, he was a
gold and silver miner, and that's why he wrote that, and that's how I signed the books.
You're bringing a little tear to my eye.
I'll give you another one. I wanted to talk to you about how we got the name of the book.
Yeah,
right,
please
if you
do.
Live to get there. So in 1869, Jane Waterman, who was my great-grandmother's half-sister, wrote to her saying, "I never expect to see you again in time. Give my love to your dear children. How bad they will feel to have you go to Kansas and leave them. Dear sister, write if you live to get there."
There it is.
When I read that, I thought, wow, that's what this book is really about. And the good news is she did get there, and they did correspond, although they never did get to see each other again.
Well, yeah, it is a perfect title, and I'd imagine you discovered a lot of things that you never knew about. Is there something that came up to the surface that maybe you wish you didn't learn about, that it was kind of, you know, ooh, that's an ugly part of our family history, or something that just kind of made you feel a little uneasy? Do you have any regrets at all?
None.
None. That's a good answer.
No regrets at all. These people were really solid citizens, and I think that they did not gossip about each other. They tried to support each other. Even though they didn't have much, like they shared pieces of clothing, they remade their dresses and sent to each other. They took bonnets and aprons and made it into different pieces of clothing that people could wear. So they tried to help each other. And when life dealt them tragedies or losses, they did the best they could.
It sounds like they're a truly connected family.
In 1907, my grandmother, great-grandmother, writes a letter that says, "I'm proud of my relatives so far." And I think that's how we felt when we wrote the book.
That's something that I don't think people could necessarily say. You know, how great would it be to actually say that and mean it? So that's quite something. That's really amazing. Mm-hmm. Learning about all this and seeing the connections and reading the letters and everything, did that make you kind of wish that you were there back then, or are you just happy to be here now and happy to know that you're compiling all this information for future generations?
Well, we did feel that this book was a contribution to history, and that's why it was important to write. And to have that 120-year collection, to see the consistency across the generations, we thought that that was really something important to share. I think that they did enjoy their life, and they enjoyed simple pleasures, like they went to literary societies or to debate clubs. But some things that they liked a lot were boating and fishing on the lakes around Lake Tahoe, or going on picnics in the meadows, or riding sleighs, and going to dances. That was another popular thing.
These sound like people that I could hang out with on a Saturday night, Mary Jo.
You know, they worked really hard, but I think that they had rich lives.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It really does. Were there any kind of mysteries that went unsolved? Did you ever start, oh, there's something here, there's a story here, but then you kind of hit a dead end?
Yes, there is a mystery, and that is my great-grandmother's son, Wells, left for California when he was about 17, and he disappeared. The last letter is when he's in Oxnard, California. He said he was working at a sugar beet factory, and then no letters came after that. And you can imagine to have a child disappear, how tragic that must be, and no way to find him.
Right.
Like today, we have so many ways of finding somebody. She wrote to all kinds of people that she knew in different areas of the West to see if they had seen him, and they would tell her, this was the last place I saw him. He's a good boy. You can be confident that he wouldn't go astray. And they tried to find him within their means, but they never found a trace.
And nothing turned up. Now, how old was he?
He was 17.
Wow, that's scary. Is that something that kind of bothers you, that it was never discovered, that nobody ever found him? I mean, that's just going to linger forever, right?
That will linger forever. Yes, there's no way to be sure about where he was exactly, and no way to know what happened.
Was there ever a point where you thought you got a lead and you thought, oh, we're going to find out, but then it didn't turn out? Or was it just kind of a dead end from the beginning?
It was a dead end. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are the rough parts of this, when you don't know what happened.
Right.
But a lot of people, you know, they want to know where they came from and they want to know about their family. And I myself, I don't know everything there is to know about, say, my grandma's parents or my uncle who passed away before I was born. And if there's somebody out there that kind of is thinking, I want to start to find out about my ancestors, I want to open up this Pandora's box, where did they start? You know, how do they begin? Because that's such a huge thing to do. You know, it took you 14 years to write this book.
Well, Ancestry.com is a good place to start. Yankee Magazine, asking for people who are descendants of so-and-so, is another good place to start. Your local libraries and their genealogy sessions are good places.
And I'd imagine that once you get the name of one person, that kind of leads you to, you know, two more people, and then you've got four more names, and then it just keeps going from there.
Well, that's right.
Right.
And sometimes you just get a phone call out of the blue. You think that you're totally stuck, and the phone will ring, and it'll be someone saying, I think I'm related to you. And then every time we hit a dead end, something would happen, and we would be advanced a little further. It might take a while, but something always happens.
Yeah, it always leads to somewhere, you hope, anyway.
Yeah.
So what's the one piece of advice that you can give somebody if they do start on this journey and they're thinking, oh, this is too much, this is too overwhelming, there's too many names, I can't do this, I'm not getting anywhere. What piece of advice can you leave them with to say, you know what, it's worth it, you can?
I would say don't stop. And if you get stuck, there are plenty of people out there who have an expertise that you can hire to help you.
And probably somebody else in your own family, too. I'm sure if one person has these questions, I'm sure your cousin or your brother or your so-and-so has them, too.
You know, family gatherings are wonderful places to seek out information, asking people what stories they know about the family, what are the legends that have been passed down. And sometimes it's not just family members. It might be friends of family who have a different slant.
Right.
And yeah, sometimes it's just going through the attic and finding out what's in those old boxes up there.
Yeah, there are some hidden treasures, I bet, in people's attics and basements. I wouldn't doubt it. And I always say, too, if somebody is telling you a verbal story about your ancestors, you know, your great uncle or your great aunt, I would say jot it down, because it's going to be difficult to remember 20 years from now when you want to tell your own kids. Just
keep a
journal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good to have a notebook or a journal to record these things in. And then you know what the questions are, what the gaps are, so when you're with other people, you can ask what they know.
Exactly, and then you can kind of start to fill in the blanks. Mary Jo, I could talk to you all day, because this really is so interesting. I can't wait to read more of the book. It's Right If You Live to Get There, as in write a letter, W-R-I-T-E. We're going to put all the information up at us99.com. It's rightifyoulivetogetthere.com, correct? That's the website for
the
book?
That's right.
And where
That's
can people get the book?
The book is available through my website, rightifyoulivetogetthere.com. It's also in paperback and ebook on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Excellent. And I want to say, if any millennials are out there listening right now, I would say pick this up, because it's such a fascinating thing to see how life was back then. It wasn't instant. You had to have patience, and the communication really had to be there. You get to see the handwriting. You get to see the doodles on the pages. You get to see, for the photographs, their facial expressions. It's so fascinating. It's nothing at all like it is now. So this is such an interesting read, Mary Jo.
Thank you so very much.
And thank you so much for being on the show. We appreciate it. You have a good day.
Bye.